Good evening. On a beautiful spring morning quite some time ago, a Mr. Gee of Marlow, New Hampshire, was trudging along toward his farmhouse along the country road after sitting up all night with a sick neighbor, when he saw in the road just ahead of him a horse and buggy without any driver. The reins were dragging in the dust, and the old nag looked as though she'd come quite a distance. So Mr. Gee got in, drove home, and hitched the horse in his front yard where her owner could see her if he should come up the road looking for his runaway team. Mr. Gee changed his clothes, mixed up some mash for the hens, watered the stock, and was about to have breakfast when a feller on horseback drove into the yard all out of breath. "Say," he said, "the bank over to Charlestown's been robbed, and there's a $500 reward for the money and another $500 for the robbers. Can I have a drink of water? That's a good-looking calf you got. Well, I got to be going, spread the alarm." And he was off in a cloud of dust. Mr. Gee had been drowsy, but now he was wide awake, thinking how wonderful it would be if he could catch the robbers and get that $1,000. He decided not to bother with breakfast, so he unhitched the horse he'd found and was about to start for town when his eye saw something pink protruding from a buffalo robe in the back of the buggy. He unrolled the robe, and there was a pink poke bonnet, a shawl, and a petticoat. And under all this feminine paraphernalia were several cloth bags bulging with greenbacks and gold and silver coins. As Clifford Wilbur of Keene tells it, fortune had not only knocked on Mr. Gee's door, it had kicked it wide open. And you can bet your best pair of go-to-meeting galluses, Mr. Gee lost no time in getting over to Charlestown to show what he'd found and claim the reward. A big crowd was milling round the bank when he drove up, and he turned the wagon over to the first policeman he saw. Then he pushed his way right into the bank and stood in front of the cashier's cage, impatiently rubbing his hands for that $500. Finally, an old codger emerged from a back room and handed Mr. Gee $400, saying, "Cost us $100 for messengers and such, so we've deducted. But if you catch the robbers, we'll give you $500 extra." Mr. Gee took the $400 and went out to mingle with the crowd, who hailed him as a hero. Meanwhile, the police were examining the wagon and the female duds. And one of the officers found a label sewed inside the buffalo robe with the name Samuel Barton, Jr. That didn't mean a thing to him, but to the big city sleuths it meant plenty. "Ho, ho, Sammy Barton, eh? Well, now we're getting somewhere." Seems this Sammy Barton and two brothers named Lon had been caught robbing a bank over in New York State. Barton and one of the Lon boys named Otis was already in the clink at Oxford, and a reward was out for the other Lon brother, whose name was Abijah. As I said, this robbery took place in spring. But it was the following December before the law caught up with Bijah over in Albany, and Deputy Sheriff Baker was sent to fetch him back to New Hampshire. Most robbers of those times were ugly mugs and rough-spoken, but Bijah was just the opposite. He was meek as Moses, and with his small pointed face, peaked nose, long sideburns, and wide-brimmed black hat, he looked almost ministerial. All the way back from Albany, he quoted scripture, and he prayed fervently that the good Lord and the citizens of Charlestown would forgive him for his indiscretion in robbing the bank. He was glad, oh, so very glad, yes, that all the money had been returned to the rightful owners. When the deputy sheriff asked Bijah why he robbed the bank, he had a simple and ready answer. It was Satan's idea, yes. He kept whispering in my ear, "Take the money and bail out your dear brother Otis." You know, Deputy, the devil is everywhere, yes, just waiting to tempt good, honest men like me. Great round tears coursed down Bijah's cheeks, and he wiped them away with a big bandana handkerchief. Now, I don't know how true it is, but they say the day that Bijah arrived in handcuffs, all the stores and schools were closed so everyone could get out and get a good look at the bank robber. But all they saw was a middle-aged man looking very sad. The sheriff said he was the most penitent prisoner he'd ever had handcuffs on. Taken before the directors of the bank, who were all good church members, Bijah tearfully told of his bout with Satan. And before he finished, all the bank officials were wiping their eyes. He ended his confession with an impassioned plea for clemency. And he added, "And gentlemen, if you will figure out what my indiscretion has cost you, I'll pay every cent right now. Yes, that I will." Well, they scribbled and scratched and added and subtracted, and finally, with a good deal of reluctance, they handed him the statement. Poor Bijah. He shook his head in shame. Then he got off some apt quotation from the good book, and reaching down into his pocket, he pulled out a roll of bills that would choke an elephant. He peeled off fives, tens, and twenties, and he asked for a signed receipt. Then he insisted on paying the $400 given to Mr. Gee. And because he thought the bank had cheated Mr. Gee out of $100, he left five $20 bills for him. I want to do what's right. Yes, I do, I do. Well, Bijah was arraigned in court, and the prosecuting attorney said, obviously, this good man has been influenced by the devil. All of the stolen money has been returned, and Mr. Land has been most generous. However, the judge bound Bijah over for the next term of court, but he allowed bail in the sum of $2,000. And before Bijah could peel off any more of his greenbacks, two reputable citizens stepped up and slapped down $1,000 apiece. Well, by now, Bijah was ready to talk to the reporters. Describing the robbery, he said, it was Satan who told me what to do. He told me to get a friend and dress him up in a skirt and bonnet and have him wait for me in the bucket. And I did. Then I went in, pried open the vault, and took the money. I put it in the back of the buggy, climbed in, and we drove off. At the foot of the hill between Drewsville and Marlow, the poor old horse looked so tired. Yes. We both got out and walked. I went ahead, and my friend come on behind, on account of not being used to skirts on a rough road. I reached the top of the hill and waited and waited. Yes. But that wagon never showed up. Now, this is good. Seems that halfway up that hill, there's a place called Lover's Lane, where the horse had been many times when her owner had been a-courting. And left to herself, the old nag just turned off the main road, completely upsetting the plans of the bank robbers. Well, when Bijah Land left Charlestown, New Hampshire under $2,000 bail, a more contrite crook can't be imagined. And a big crowd was on hand to wish him luck and to assure him he would surely be acquitted when the trial came up. Court convened on scheduled time, but Bijah Land was nowhere in evidence. And the good country folks learned that it doesn't pay to take too much stock in glib expressions of sorrow and alligator's tears, for Bijah jumped his bail and disappeared. Now I want to tell you about the Wingate brothers, Eddie and Freddie. They worked in the Sudbury Street establishment in Boston, which specialized in big iron safes and bank vaults. One day, when they were helping move a big burglar-proof safe out into the yard so the artist could put on the filigree and gold leaf, they noticed that the keys were inside the safe. So Eddie pressed them one after another into a bar of soap. And later, from these impressions, Brother Freddie made a set of duplicate keys which worked perfectly. But it was 11 months before the big safe was sold and shipped to a newly organized savings bank down in Augusta, Maine. The Wingate brothers left the Boston firm and also went to Augusta, where they had no difficulty in getting a helper's job in the new bank building where the vault was being installed. The opening of the new savings bank was a grand success. Big bouquets of flowers, telegrams, 10-cent cigars, tall silk hats, and so forth. But the banquet that night was somewhat marred by a lot of noise from an auction room next door, the chief noisemaker being Freddie Wingate. He hollered and bid and banged furniture around, so the bankers and their ladies next door wouldn't hear Brother Eddie cutting a hole in the partition. Well, the next morning, the cashier of the Augusta, Maine Savings Bank got the shock of his life when he found a hole in the wall. But as the new big burglar-proof safe was shut tight and locked, he didn't worry any until he opened the vault and found it as bare as old Mother Hubbard's cupboard. Every red cent, well, to be exact, over $35,000 was gone. And that, as you can imagine, was rather embarrassing on the first business day of a new savings bank. As this was obviously an inside job, suspicion fell upon the two strange boys from Boston, and Eddie Wingate was picked up and held for questioning. At first, he refused to talk, but when they turned the heat on, he up and confessed, and he agreed to show the sheriff where he'd hidden the money if he could do this after dark some night. Released from jail, he led the sheriff's party across lots, up a steep hill, through some bushes to the rear of a big building. And pulling a wooden shutter loose, he propped it with a stick, raised the sash, dropped into the basement, and motioned the officers to follow him. It was dark and damp and musty in the cellar, but the officers followed Eddie's voice as he led them through a labyrinth of cold, cobwebby corridors and up a short flight of wooden stairs. Then keys jangled, a rusty lock squeaked, the door opened, and they all stepped into a huge carpeted chamber that seemed rather strangely familiar to the sheriff. Enough light from the street lamps filtered in through the high windows for the sheriff and the officers to finally recognize where they were. Well, I'll be, and no wonder. They were in the Hall of Representatives of the State House. Eddie waved them nonchalantly into comfortable leather-covered seats and said, "Take it easy, gents. I'll get the money as soon as I get undressed." One of the cops whispered, "Hey, this guy's gone nuts. Shall I take him in?" The sheriff shook his head and nodded toward Eddie, who was removing his coat, trousers, two woolen shirts, and then, clad only in his shoes and his red flannel underwear, he marched up to the speaker's platform. The sheriff whispered to one of the deputies, "You know, Bill, I've seen a lot of queer sights, but this takes the cake. What's he doing, pulling up the carpet?" Already, Eddie had part of the carpet rolled away, and from beneath it, he removed two loose boards, laid them across the settee, then feet first, the red-flanneled robber disappeared under the rostrum. Several seconds went by. Then a loud thud echoed through the Hall of Representatives as Eddie Wingate shoved one box after another through the opening in the speaker's platform. Then came the money bags, and finally Eddie, soaked with perspiration and covered with dust. He brushed his hands, checked off the boxes and bags on his fingers, and said, "I guess that's all of it, gentlemen. How's about something to eat?" Well, a team was sent up to the State House to pick up the load of loot, and Eddie and his captors went back to the jail for a well-earned breakfast. As he dunked his donut, Eddie Wingate explained how he and his brother had made the duplicate keys back in Boston, followed the safe to Augusta, cut a hole in the partition, and cleaned out the works. "But why," asked the sheriff, "did you hide the money under the speaker's stand in the Hall of Representatives? And how did you know how to get in?" "Well," said Eddie, souping his coffee from his saucer, "I'll tell you. I figured the last place that anybody would look for that money would be in the State House. You'll have to ask Brother Freddie about the rest of it." Freddie was finally captured in Cambridge, brought back to Maine, tried, and sentenced to a long term in state's prison in Thomaston. Eddie Wingate got off with bail at $2,000, just as Bijah Lund had up in New Hampshire. And like Bijah, he flew the coop. Freddie Wingate proved such a model prisoner, he was allowed to work in the blacksmith shop. And watching his chance, he borrowed a bunch of keys one day and pressed them one after another into a bar of soap. Then, whenever he had the opportunity, he worked on a set of duplicate keys. And on a dark, rainy night, he quietly let himself out of state's prison at Thomaston, Maine, locked all the doors behind him, returned to Boston, where Brother Eddie was waiting for him. And soon after that, they disappeared, just as the Lund brothers had. Smart fellas, weren't they? Next week, I'm going to tell about some old-fashioned April Fool pranks which I think our listeners will find amusing. And on April 5th, I'm going to tell the story of the famous Worcester Church and the woman who lived there on half a dime a day.